because mortars took too long, and you could also get an instant reaction if you put something out there. Because you, and also, when you went into an area of an open field, and you didn't, you know, you always tested out an area all the way around as if you could get a reaction where you crossed an area. You know, you could always put some rounds in there.
Or for an LZ, creating an LZ.
Yeah, and but if you needed some heavier stuff,
right,
you always had to call in mortars, or you had to bring along that damn, the old bazooka type. And it really didn't look like we'd come up with anything better from what I see on TV. You know, I don't know why we don't have any RPGs like the other guys have got. Those things, you know. But anyway,
right,
you still had, if we, the, that what we had there was good, but to have it as a machine gun pod, wow.
And that would have been helpful to you
as a defensive item.
Yep.
When you had out there in the bush, yep, these support elements, you know,
mm-hmm,
for 105 howitzers to fire support rounds,
mm-hmm,
wherever,
mm-hmm,
and you know, places where we, where the hills went back and forth. There's a famous one you probably heard up there called the Rock Pile.
Rock Pile, yes.
Which
sir.
Is really, I talked to one of my buddies who was up there,
mm-hmm,
it, which is really not much bigger than the size of three ping pong tables at the top. And all the foxholes digging was down around the side.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, we talked about if we had one of those, it would have sure made a lot of difference.
Man. Well, Gary, let me ask you, now that we've sort of surveyed the problems with the strategy, the flip side of that, of course, is what was going on in the States, and particularly, I think, to your mind, problems with reporting about the war and what was being conveyed to people in the U.S. And you returned to the U.S. from Vietnam, the middle of 1968, am I right?
May.
In May, 68. And you went to, you had a year's additional service requirement. Is that right? So you went to
six
Camp
Lejeune.
6 months, I'm sorry. So, and you went to Camp Lejeune.
Mm-hmm.
And yesterday when we talked, I asked you about if you saw any sort of elements of the growing anti-war movement. And you said, well, not really, you know, Camp Lejeune in North Carolina, not a lot of that going on. And then you were back in Texas. But no doubt you were watching at least some of the television coverage of the war during 68, 69, 70, and on it goes. Can you talk a little bit about the impact that had as you see it now?
You mean after I left Camp Lejeune?
Well, yeah. And at that time, as you were watching the television reporting from Vietnam.
I don't remember much about being at Camp Lejeune.
Okay.
But all I can tell you about is I wish I had gone back at that time. I will tell you that when I landed at LAX,
uh-huh,
I was there in an area with a couple other Marines who were going back to Dallas.
Sure.
And there were two guys from Notre Dame with sweatshirts on. I'll never forget them. And they came up and started harassing these two Marines enlisted. There were another area. You know, it's just still the same thing. We talked, you know, but they kind of kept themselves.
By saying, what were these guys saying? Do you remember?
Names?
Well, what were they saying to these enlisted?
Oh, they're just harassing them. I can't remember what they're doing, but they got in their face and were harassing them.
Uh-huh.
And, you know, I can't remember what they're doing, but it was obvious they were harassing them.
Uh-huh. Giving them a hard time.
Yeah. Uh-huh. And I started to get up and go over there and, you know,
uh-huh,
get them and say something to them. Or I was going to go get the police. I can't remember which one I could do.
Uh-huh.
But before I did anything, one Marine decked one up. I mean, he was out cold. He was stretched out.
Mm-hmm.
And the other one took off like a rocket. And I'll never forget. I remember that O.J. commercial. that guy. You remember when he used to run through that airport?
Yes.
And over those suitcases?
Yeah, with the Hertz commercial. Yeah, I remember.
That's what that guy was doing. I mean, he was flying. You know, I mean, he was launched. the people in the deal there started laughing, you know, and how fast he was moving. And every time I have seen a Notre Dame football game, I just wish they'd get their butt beat 150-0, you know. I've hated Notre Dame ever since. And so anyway, I remember that. When I came home, I had talked to my monitor. Your monitor is a guy that's the head of your MOS, okay?
Yes.
And the Marines are small. And, you know, we were actually drafting people by then. That was not a good time. This is 68. Things are going downhill. The president resigned, Walter Cronkite has already issued his proclamation that we're not going to win. And so, you know, we're looking at a longer war.
Mm-hmm.
And so, I've lost my train of thought.
That's okay. We were talking about what the press was kind of showing and telling about the Vietnam era, and you were talking about your own return to the U.S. and those incidents that happened at LAX, and then Walter Cronkite, and then LBJ decided not to run again in 68. The buildup is happening. I mean, the number of people getting drafted.
I know I was going to talk about
Marine Corps.
So you're going to have to stick with me here because
I'm going to stick with you, Gary. No problem.
There's a point in time here where I had some medical treatment that really shocked the hell out of my memory system.
Okay, that's fine.
When you come into areas like this, my memory is really going to be hurting. I'll remember this stuff, but I'll be talking and I'll forget where I am.
Well, can you tell me what medical? I mean, this is again at your discretion. Can you explain a little bit about what happened to you so that people have a context for this?
Yeah, I had I think there's 21 or 24 shock treatments.
Okay, because why?
Hmm?
Why was that prescribed, and why did they do that?
I'll explain to you when I get there.
Sure.
All right, anyway, now what were we talking about? I was just talking about, I talked to my monitor about when I was going back. And in most cases, you were going to go back no sooner than 12 or 13 months.
Mm-hmm.
And I was going back, I think, like 7.
Back to Vietnam?
Yeah.
Yes.
And quite frankly, I wasn't ready to go back in 7 months. You know? So I made probably the biggest mistake of my life. That's probably the biggest mistake of my life because it affected my career or it affected my life up until today. Because what I attended and went through, during this time as a civilian caused me major problems. And I've often thought if I went back, if I got nailed, I got nailed. If I came back, maybe I might have stayed in. Mm-hmm. I would have had, you know, 2 tours in Vietnam would have pretty set you well up for a good career. And I would have been in long enough already. You know, I would have been at least, you know, 7 or 8 years. And at that point, you're at with 2 tours in Vietnam, you know, you've got a pretty good career going.
Yes, sir.
Of course, I don't know. Maybe there's a possibility to go back a third time. I don't think so. But anyway, I didn't go. And so, went home.
Back here to Texas?
Yeah, and we took a tour. I can remember went through New Orleans, and that was my first taste of hippies. And I was looking for a fight.
Mm-hmm.
And it was my first time I realized my wife really didn't appreciate it and really didn't care. And I remember there was one time I was walking down the street, and here came these 2 guys. I didn't care how big or how small, but they were hippies. I heard about it, knew about them, and I made an effort to walk right between them And, you know, they were arm in arm, and I walked right between them and did a 180, and I was ready to take them on. And they didn't do anything but look to me like, who is this fool? And they turned around and walked on.
Mm-hmm.
And I remember she and I had an argument about it, you know.
Mm-hmm.
And I realized then that she didn't want any part of it. She didn't care about it.
Do you mean she didn't care about you?
She didn't care about my actions. She didn't care about the war. Her life was going to be built on, I guess, a family, going on building a house, and, you know, doing the civilian thing.
Mm-hmm.
And whatever was happening outside her front door and on anything on the other side of the mall or past her mother's house just didn't count.
Okay.
Politics was nothing.
I see.
That proved to be the case all the way.
Mm-hmm.
She didn't know the difference between a DMZ and the driveway. That was my first inkling that there was not going to be any love in this, or assistance in this program.
Okay.
So anyway, I remember asking this lady at this store I was buying some stuff from. I said, where'd you get all these damn hippies? She says, probably from your town. I thought that was a great line.
That was pretty quick.
Great line.
Uh-huh.
So anyway, we went to Irving but before then, I got to back up.
Okay.
When I first came home from Vietnam,
yep.
Instead of going before I went to Camp Lejeune, I came home first for a couple of weeks.
Mm-hmm. You had some leave, probably.
Yeah,
mm-hmm.
I came home from LAX going, my God, what's it going to be like in Dallas?
Mm-hmm.
And I came home and I saw some hippies and I didn't see anything doing it wrong and everything went fine here. And in fact, I went to my father's Rotary Club and which I'm a member of now, and I was well received, everything's fine. There's not going to be a problem, you know.
Right.
And it was, and everything. I stayed a couple of weeks, and Irving was great, you know. And
mm-hmm.
So took off, and then fast forward to coming back through New Orleans, and I can't remember anything what happened there other than that. So I got a job in Irving with the phone company selling switchboards.
Mm-hmm.
And I first of all, coming out of the military was a different life. And coming back from a war was a different life, two different things. And then coming back to an environment of dealing and sitting across the table from these hippies, and some of them weren't really anti-war or whatever. They were just had long hair down to the knees the way they were. And,
mm-hmm.
and you know, I didn't like them.
Mm-hmm.
You know, even though they might not have been anti-war. They were just those, you know, kind of people.
Sure.
And it was hard for me to get along with. And so I could remember after they hired me, you know, and I'd go out to dinner with my boss and some other people, you know, and they'd be talking about, you know, the PBX equipment and things that were going on in town and all this kind of stuff. And I try to relate, you know, and I try to understand. And I sat there and I couldn't, you know, and I'd be quiet, you know, because I didn't know what to say, you know. And my boss told me one time, he said, you know, you'll be a salesman. You're going to have to learn to talk up. I said, well, okay. So the next time we went out, you know, and I started talking about some of my adventures over there and some of the stuff that went on. I remember one time we went down to a gathering of all the salesmen in the company down in San Angelo. And I can remember on the way down, I was riding with my boss, and I was still talking about my adventures
Your adventures in Vietnam?
Yeah. Uh-huh. You know, uh-huh. I had 1,000 stories, and everybody just got quiet, you know.
Right.
And I remember saying, you know, he said, Gary, I don't think anybody really understand what you're talking about. And I said, yeah, I guess you're right. And I said, I just shut up, you know. I couldn't do one way or the other way. And it was just this time I realized I had really made a mistake. You know, my wife didn't care, you know. And if I'd gone back, she probably would have left me anyway. And that, it would have hurt, but at least it would have been over with.
Mm-hmm.
And then, too, I'm in an environment where I can't talk about anything, you know. And also, I had left Irving, which was a mistake. I should have gone to work. My father had a business.
Yes.
And I should have gone to work with him. As I look back, we could, you know, he gave me the opportunity. I just, so young, I was still his son, okay?
Yes, uh-huh,
and
sure.
I was, it had been but 3 years earlier, and I was still just his kid. And it would have been, I just wasn't ready to go work for my dad. And I should have. So anyway.
Right. That's tough, though.
So, I went down there, and there were about 15, 20 guys there, you know, and you know, I can remember after the meetings, we all go out to dinner, and they'd hee-haw around, and, you know, and they having the best old time hee-hawing, you know, having these drinks and telling dirty jokes and laughing and just having the just the best old time in the world, you know?
Mm-hmm.
And I'm sitting there thinking about what's going on with my guys, you know? What are the guys going through right now? What are they doing, you know? And I'm reading the paper about, you know, I'm still not far out of the loop to find out what's happening around where, and all I can read is bad news, you know?
Bad news from Vietnam?
I mean, yeah, things aren't looking good.
Right. Yeah.
You know?
Yeah.
And I'm seeing these guys having the best old time stuff, you know. So I finally just, you know, didn't say anything. And then we'd go out, remember one time we went out in this parking lot, you know, and everybody's leaning against the cars and drinking and having a good time. And I kind of just moseyed away and just kind of look at things. And so I just kind of walked across the street and this old building, and, you know, this old building, and I was just kind of looking at it, you know, and look at the bricks and kind of stuff. And I guess I was over there for a while. I walked around and came back. This time the general manager came over there. I guess his boss had seen me, you know, and he, you know, he was an older guy, and he didn't have a clue,
mm-hmm.
you know. And he came over there and says, why don't you come over and join the fun, you know, and have a good time. He says, I ain't so-and-so, so-and-so, and what is your name? I said, so-and-so. And he didn't ask where I was from or anything, you know, and he was half-loaded.
Mm-hmm.
You know?
Mm-hmm.
And so I said, okay, I'll come over, you know. And so I went over and kind of stood around. You know, I got tired and couldn't wait. It was time to go to bed. And the next day we had I remember that, how tuned I was with all those guys. And really, I didn't get angry at them. I just wanted to go over and grab them and say, you guys need to kind of keep it quiet, you know. You know, you need to think a while. You need to kind of cool it.
Mm-hmm.
And so there's something else going on. So anyway, the next day we had a golf tournament. I hadn't played golf in years, but I'd had the old golf at college. And
mm-hmm.
I guess it's one of these deals where you hadn't played in so long, and this is true. I think when you first play golf and you had played a long time, you play a great game. And when you play your second game,
right.
It's absolutely horrendous.
Yes. Uh-huh.
So we went out there, and we played, and I just played, you know, unconscious. You know, everything I hit went in the hole, you know. And the rule was, don't beat the general manager.
Oh.
Well, I didn't think anything about that crap, you know.
I
thought they were all kidding, you know. And I beat him by 2 strokes.
Uh-huh.
And people were looking at me. And sure enough, he came up and handed me a trophy, and this guy glared at me.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, he actually glared at me. I mean, he was not happy. And so put it in the trunk of the car, and And we were driving home, and Jerry said, you know, you shouldn't have won that sucker. I said, what? And he might present a problem, you know. I said, I didn't know anything about it. Well, didn't you hear people talk about it? I said, yeah, but I couldn't, you know, I don't know how to lose, you know. I thought they were kidding. I said, I never heard of losing anything in my life, you know.
Right.
And he said, well, it's called politics, and when you're in the corporate world, you don't know how to do it. And I go, ding, bruh. Third thing I need to get out of this program.
Mm-hmm.
So anyway, I went home, and I took the trophy, and I remember sit down, and she asked me what was going on, and I told her what had happened, you know, and it went one ear and right out the other. So, she didn't find it amusing or anything, you know, and she changed the subject about her mother or about something they're going to do at the house or, just didn't even make a dent about where I was coming from.
Mm-hmm.
And so I remember taking the trophy and took the garbage out and took it out there with it because I didn't want to see it.
Right.
And so then one night, next thing I could remember, we were in Denton. And I can't remember I think it was really before we were in Denton. I think it was in Irving, and we watched TV. And somewhere, or maybe it was in North Carolina,
That's okay, don't worry about it.
The treatments I took wiped out a hell of a lot of memory factor.
That's all right.
In fact, I don't think they even hardly do these shock treatments anymore.
No, sir. No.
And I had 24 of them without my...
When did this happen?
I'll get that.
Okay,
So anyway, it was around the time that I do remember the man landing on the moon. I do know that.
Mm-hmm.
That's about all I remember. But mm-hmm. I do remember I do remember Walter Cronkite. I remember coming home and feeling very good about myself and that I knew we had won the Tet Offensive.
Yeah.
While I had heard it, and going out on patrols and hearing people talk and the caisson was held and we took back the embassy and that I heard the goal was to take over all the cities and they didn't take over any of them,
right.
You know.
Uh-huh.
And my philosophy was, you know, you could take it, but you got to hold it to win it, you know. And last man on top of the sandbag of sand, last man on top of the, well, you should play on top of the sand pile. Last man on top of the sand pile is going to be the winner.
Mm-hmm.
You know, you can bomb it and strafe it and all you want, the way the Marines look at it. But the man that's standing on it is the one that's holding it.
Mm-hmm.
Well, you throw that to the Air Force all the time. You dig the deepest hole you want, but the guy that's at the bottom of that hole is still the one's holding it. And I remember Walter Cronkite coming over there and saying, getting on TV and saying that the war was unwinnable. And I go, where did he get this? What did he know? What does he know? What's he talking about?
Mm-hmm.
You know, I mean, we were talking about coming home. You know, there was nobody else, you know, they didn't do anything. They didn't keep anything. And it wasn't until years later that I did some digging and realized that we had killed, in that three-week period of time, around 54,000 people. No, 52,000 people, known killed, 52,000 people in three weeks' time, which was almost the total number of people that we lost, which is like 56,000
in the entire
war.
Right, right.
And I also learned years later on that General Gap was on there. He's now dead. Who got? And I remember this like I was sitting here. I know the chair I was sitting in. He said, "Yes, we lost the Tet Offensive.
Mm-hmm.
No doubt about it. Our attempt to take over all the cities and villages in which we hoped that the local villages would rise up, in which some of them did, and our bill and take over the cities, in which we were able to do, but we were unable to hold them. That was our mistake. We were not able to hold them against the massive firepower of the Americans.
Mm-hmm.
We weren't able to take over Quezon. We were trying to turn that into another Dim Bim Phu.
Mm-hmm.
Now, if you want to explain what Dim Bim Phu is, you want to explain what that is?
Well, most people will know that was the major French defeat that caused them to withdraw. Oh. Yeah.
That's why they wanted to capture those hills so bad.
Sure. The hills around.
Yeah, and that's why mm-hmm. General did such a great job with that super gaggle because, mm-hmm. you know, they needed those hills.
General Carey. Mm-hmm.
And they needed those hills.
Yes.
But anyway, so, but he said, yeah, we didn't win that. But he said, we did win, so many words. And I've been trying to find this mm-hmm. app for you to look up. But I don't know where it was. It's been almost 5 years since I've heard it.
Mm-hmm.
It probably was on the History Channel. And he said, but we did win. We lost the battle. We lost the war. And that we won the psychological minds of the American people through the press by American people being told that the Americans weren't going to win the war.
Mm-hmm.
Well, that just, when I heard that years later, I just got that much madder because that was Walter Cronkite.
Right.
And told me just how much power the media had and how much power that idiot had. And as a result, you know, the war went on another 5 or 6 years. And we, you know, it ended the way it did. And the channel that I was watching this, and I remember this, is that, you know, he said they lost the Tet Offensive, and it would have been a good time that that this channel made this, and it's not the press, it was this historical document.
Sure.
And I can remember probably it was true, but it would have been a good time that that the North Vietnamese probably would have been more willing to make a negotiated settlement. We could have ended the war right there.
Mm-hmm.
You know, they were whipped. But he made the judgment that we were not ready when they attacked, and that the people saw on TV that we were fighting our own embassy. He made a point of that. We were not ready, unable to hold anything.
Mm-hmm.
And that didn't bother to tell them, you know, that we took it back. You know, you could just simply reword. It was just a simple way of rewording the thing and saying, yeah, they attacked, but you know, we took back. And then their objective of taking over, you know, the intelligence people knew this. All he had to do was talk to intelligence people, and he probably knew this, and say that their goal of taking over these cities had failed.
Mm-hmm.
And also tell, you know, how many people they probably lost. And say that the American forces did shine, you know, did shine their best. But no, he, you know, within 30 seconds, he cost us so many lives, and cost us the war. And on top of that, cost guys like me pain and misery for years. And even today, a friend of mine told me he was out on the West Coast, and he said there's an area just outside of San Diego, outside of San Francisco, and he says there's a Long Beach Wall, and you can drive along that area,
mm-hmm.
and about every 100 yards, you'll see guys sitting on that wall looking west for miles. They're all Vietnam vets, just for miles, and they just sit up there.
Hmm.
And all those guys are thanks to Walter Cronkite. And so, you know, thanks to him, he cost us the war. I mean, that's why I hate the guy so much. And I tried to tell that to a friend of mine who is a well-known author, columnist with the Dallas News,
mm-hmm.
extremely liberal.
Mm-hmm.
We're best friends. And I told him my story, and he feels for me. In fact, he says, I wish you were president. But when I told him about Walter Cronkite and this,
mm-hmm.
you can see that it's kind of like, boy, this is really off the wall. Does he really believe this? And I said, you think this is off the wall, and this is something that did not happen. I said, I'm going to tell you one more time. And I said, I want you to listen. It makes sense. Because after all this happened, within a month, the president resigned. And it was said on TV, and I couldn't find it written down. I just didn't have the time and the energy and didn't care about looking it up.
Mm-hmm.
Johnson resigned because he said, if they believe Walter Cronkite, they're not going to believe me. So once he resigned, it was downhill forever for the war. All American troops here that our president resigned. You know, North Vietnam here, as our top leaders resigned. You know, we're not going to win that sucker.
But did it, Gary, did it pave the way, though, for President Nixon? I mean, it's unclear, of course, because, you know, history that didn't happen is a guessing game. But if President Johnson had run again, Mr. Nixon might not have been elected in 1968. And I mean, if I'm gathering correctly what you're saying, Nixon did a good job. He, you know, opened the way for the incursion into Cambodia. He took some of the bombing constraints off. In fact, by what, 1972, he ordered the bombing of Hanoi. But I'm not confronting what you're saying. I'm just trying to open a new way of asking you about it and seeing whether you think there's any good that came out of it.
Out of his resigning?
Yeah, out of President Johnson stepping aside.
Well, I think that there was some major good data because Nixon was elected.
Yeah.
And as far as saving his guys' lives, it was too little, too late.
Yes, yeah, I hear you.
I tell you, you talk to any military guys, and especially the POWs, the guys like me, and a lot of us guys there, Nixon's our hero. And people say, oh, hey, can you stand Nixon?
Yeah, yes, sir.
He did that, and I said, let me tell you what he did.
Yes, sir.
First of all, he did what he's supposed to do. He went out and bombed the hell out of North Vietnam, and what he was supposed to have done. Those guys were sitting up there, and what he did, he basically bombed those guys back to the negotiation table.
Yes, sir.
And we ended the war.
Mm-hmm.
He bombed them and bombed the Lombardy Ridge is what they call them.
Mm-hmm.
And we lost a lot of people. And he also opened it up and let the people in the Air Force set up their own bombing runs.
Mm-hmm. Yes, sir.
In fact, from what I understand from Pete and some other people, they set up their own bombing runs, different altitudes, different directions, and didn't do the McNamara thing, you know, straight high and level. You know, same route, same everything. They did their own bombing routes and just bombed the living whatever out of them, which they were terrified of them. And they finally came back to the table, which they supposedly negotiated a peace treaty, which they violated from the minute we left Dodge.
Mm-hmm.
And you know, we all admire him for doing that. And also, there was intelligence reports coming back that we found out later that it had been so long since we had been up there bombed anything that there was some input that there were some people beginning to lose it. They thought that the war was really and truly was over and they were actually forgotten.
Now, do you mean POWs?
Yeah.
Uh-huh.
And so therefore he definitely wanted the battle, the bombing to go on. Because, you know, they were losing it. Because they also were telling them, you know, war's over, bombing's over, you know, we've won, you're going to be here the rest of your life. And, you know, they were beginning to believe it. So he went north and bombed them.
How did you, Gary, how did you feel when, and I again, this might be something that you don't remember spontaneously, but when the POWs were released, do you remember that?
Extreme anger.
Okay.
But let me go back to the other thing. He also let us go with an incursion into Cambodia and things. And
right.
I couldn't understand why people were. But of course, I understood also the hippies were running the world now. And I was just so happy that, you know, the guys over there in Vietnam were finally getting a break for a few days, you know, because they just bombed whatever they had over there and, you know, and took out so much stuff.
Mm-hmm.
And so the guys in Vietnam had a few days rest, you know. It's just sad we couldn't continue doing it. And so, yeah, I mean, I think he did us some real good.
Mm-hmm.
And but even if he had stayed in office, I don't know what would have. We might have gotten out with a better program. But now, what was your next question?
Well, I was just going to ask if you remembered about the POWs being released.
Yeah, and I was angry at the what I had heard was, by the way they had been treated up
yes.
there.
Yes, sir.
And
yes, sir.
I was angry about that, and even more angry when I found out how badly they've been treated, and then when I heard about what Jane Fonda had done when she'd gone up there, then the anger just ripped
mm-hmm.
me in two.
Mm-hmm.
And watching her on TV,
mm-hmm.
And I watched TV at the time, and Linda again just could have cared less. She was watching Days of Our Lives or something. You know,
mm-hmm.
going at the ball, and, you know. And, anyway, what's your next question?
Well, let me ask about time going on. In 1975, of course, the final evacuation of Americans from Saigon, and then the overrunning, really, of Saigon by North Vietnamese troops. Certainly General Kerry, who is a friend of yours, was deeply involved in making sure that as many Americans and South Vietnamese employees and supporters got out as possible. But, you know, how did that hit you? I get that you were, you know, having some difficulties during this period, and I just wonder if that contributed to this. Things.
Being the first of my family and the first American to lose a war, at least in terms of not being like other Americans,
mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm. service people,
yes, sir,
made me feel like a loser.
Mm-hmm.
Even though I knew that I don't remember a battle of us ever losing,
mm-hmm.
but not winning. It hurt. You know, I can remember staying up tonight and say, God, why not have to be the generation that lost? You know, and I always dreamed one time, or always thought one time, if I ever went to war, would I ever be in the generation that lost?
And mm-hmm.
Guess what? I was. And it was a hard pill to swallow.
Yes, sir.
And you know, even as recently, and I got to mention other countries like BBC, the British Broadcasting Company.
Mm-hmm.
I'm doing so well now
mm-hmm.
that with the news, and like with this, how I'm handling it so much better, but I still don't watch it, but I can see it and I can. You know, I can just say, give me a break. I saw, you know, this year was the anniversary of the war being over.
Yes, sir.
And this British broadcaster was talking about the Americans, how long it took for us to learn how to lose a war and to handle it. Okay. And, I mean, that's, you know, you're touching something right there.
Mm-hmm.
You know, mm-hmm. how long it took us to learn how to. Become accustomed to lose a war, and now we're becoming accustomed to do so. Maybe, perhaps we could learn to now maybe to open the doors for free trade and all that, and really get along with our former enemies. And of course, the thing that pops in my mind is, you know, sure thing, pal. Just as soon as they give us a very formal apology for the way they treated our POWs, and secondly, for the way they piecemealed our MIAs during the latter 4 years of the war with the remains that they found. You know, they did that to the utmost in getting what they wanted, because they knew by the relation that they found three more remains, and I'm sure they had a bunch of remains up there, that they were willing to let go if America would own, if America would do whatever. And that was basically blackmail. And, of course, the American families would say, yeah, do it. Do it. That may be my father, or maybe my brother, or whatever. And they used their MIAs even for blackmail. And that is, you know, that infuriates me. And also for another country to look at us as saying we are getting used to losing the war, you know, I think that infuriates me. And if I could talk to the guy, I would say, you know, you guys in Britain have lost so damn many wars. Maybe you have gotten used to it. But, you know, we haven't gotten used to losing because we haven't lost any. And we don't know how to lose for one. We don't know how to lose one graciously. And we haven't lost one yet, sir. But, you know, it's taken on the censor. And I wonder why he said that. And it was either out of just pure stupidity and ignorance, or he was just taking a jab at us. I don't know which one, but he got his bid in. And I just...
But this is partly why, Gary, isn't it, that you try to avoid watching the news.
Yeah, I don't
anymore.
Watch. I don't watch. The only news I watch is Fox. Because they're fair. And in fact, if they had that bid on TV, they would probably get the guy on there and they'd nail him. You know, they'd nail him to the wall. That's why he'd do something like that. And they're constantly criticizing their open media, you know, the big media for the way they do. And they'll show things that they've said. You know, they showed one that I saw on my email, on my cover page on my, and what, I used to have a cover sheet when I was turning on my computer, and it was CNN, you know, what it was. And they'd have the hotline today, and one of them, when they had on there, and this one I got rid of, it says, 100,000 civilians killed since the Bush War. I mean, if that's not a political statement and a slanderous statement, you know, by saying the Bush War, and then saying 100,000 civilians, of which they don't know, and not telling you how many of those 100,000 were killed by their own terrorists, like dropping a bomb when those 26 kids were standing around. You know, how many of them used this in front of them when they went across the street?
Yeah, shields.
You know, and you know, not telling, you know, not telling the full facts and grouping them together. They showed that. And of course, I ripped it off. You don't. I don't have anything to do with CNN anymore. But that type of stuff, just you know, that is unbelievable. The liberal media is still there and alive. So.
Well, let's turn to something else for a minute, Gary. Let me ask you about the artwork that you do.
Let's go back to the beginning where we get the artwork. Let's go back to where, if we can.
Sure.
We need to go back to the what happened afterwards.
Okay.
I mean, and this will lead into the art world.
Mm-hmm.
I think the art world is kind of the last thing, if you don't mind.
Okay.
After I went to work for Denton, went to work for the phone company, I went back from those training schools, and I went to work. I noticed when they introduced me to the ladies at the front of the office, who handle all the residential accounts, that and this was after the My Lai massacre, that a lot of the ladies didn't have much to do with me. They just hired you, you know. And I got the bag, and I said, you know, I called a friend of mine who was in the plant department. I said, you've been over there. What is this thing? Well, they say, So that's this Mili thing. They don't know what you are. They don't know whether or not you're a killer or a massacre and what you are. They don't know what to make you. They've heard so much about you being baby bombers and all this other stuff. They, you know, you're, and top of that, you're a Marine, you know.
Mm-hmm.
They don't know what you are. Where to run from you or congratulate you or, you know, or just not have anything to do with you. Right now, they don't have anything to do with you. And so I found that somewhat disconcerting. And I had a boss who was rather large, but he had a little man's ego, as I call it, and he also didn't like being upstaged by a Marine combat officer in his town.
Mm-hmm.
Because he was the big man on campus in that town. He was chamber president. He was everything. And the other guy that I took the place of was easygoing, laughed a lot, kidded around, had a good time, you know. They chuckled a lot, told jokes, went to places, you know. And I come in, and I'm pretty solemn. It's yes, sir, no, sir. And he's not my boss. He's necessarily, he's your general manager. My boss is one I was telling you about. He's back in another city. I report to him, marketing.
Mm-hmm.
And he come over, you know, and if there's something he doesn't like, he can't tell me what to do. He can just report to my manager or to my sales manager. And it got to the point several times I almost got replaced because he got tired of hearing about me. But I defended myself. And I had, what was nice, I had his boss and the general man, the manager in my office, his boss, became really out of, I don't know how it happened, he became a big supporter of me.
Mm-hmm.
And I never talked to him, but he came a big supporter of me. And he defended me in that office to my boss, and to the general manager, and to this manager here, and saved me a lot of times. And I didn't know it, but 2 years later, and he died, and I wish I could have thanked him, but he just, for some reason, he defended me and said, I'm not letting him go. So, you know, I came back, and things just, I wasn't comfortable with these long hairs coming back there. And there were some adjustments I had to make.
Sure.
Yeah, I had to make. I had to learn to let these guys, you know, I was told I didn't like these long-haired hippies coming in there. And, you know, and I didn't want them coming in there, but I had to make the adjustment, let them come in there, you know, that worked in the plant department. And I just didn't like hippies, but I was told I had to deal with them. I said, okay. And, I'm trying to think of all the instances where I can start talking. I'll just tell you in general. There were times that I would go out on campus, and it became known that North Texas particularly, you know, I was in a yellow and white car, and I had short hair, and it wasn't after long that people knew me all over campus, you know, as a Marine.
Mm-hmm. And that was a bad thing?
Yeah, I'd come back and find my car keyed. Mm. You know.
Mm-hmm.
You know what that is.
Yeah.
You're going down the side of your car.
Sure. Mm-hmm.
And I'd go back, and my boss would blame me for it, you know. And then he got to the point after a while, he wanted me to let my hair grow out. This wouldn't happen. I'd also get along better with the people out there. And I told him, I said, I'm still in reserves, and I can't do that, you know. And he said, well, I think you better consider whether or not you want to stay in the reserves. And I said, listen, the Marines come first. This job is second, you know. And you need to understand that right now. So he told my boss, that was the first time, you want to get ready because the Marines came first.
Uh-huh.
And so I don't know what my boss did or not. He never talked to me about it, but nothing ever happened for that. But I do know, from some other source, he told me, he went trickling off to my boss. I do know after a period of time, he screamed Chicken Little so many times, it didn't, he lost his effectiveness. Every little thing, he went running off to my boss. And my father even came up here one time after all this. And my father being very protective, and I didn't know he was here. But my cousin told me years later, he came up and closed the doors to this man. And it was basically on a patriotic scale, you know. He served his country. He
right.
doesn't have to fight for this country anymore being up here.
Yep.
And, cause, you know, you ain't gonna harass him anymore about this service over there. And, you know, you're going to have to deal with me. And walked out the door. And guess what? He called my boss. And he said he'd been harassed by my father. And that's how he left it. And didn't tell it was about or anything.
Mm-hmm.
Said he'd been threatened. And that's all he tells. And harassed and threatened by my father. And also that I had been put up by me. You know, which made me look cheap. And I didn't know about it because my father wasn't going to tell me about it. And I have no way of knowing. But
mm-hmm.
he came back to me later that that's what it was said,
mm-hmm.
years later. So anyway, things like that. And I was beginning to become very edgy with people. By the way, they treated me. This one time I talked to this professor, and he just guessed it. Says, "You've been in Vietnam?" I said, "Yes, sir." I had just got out of my office. And I got out, and I can remember I went out in the car, and I just steamed, you know. I am a Marine officer. I felt like being treated as somebody. And here's a jerk office guy from, you know, long hair, and probably the only thing he ever known in his life, bugs. And he's telling me to get out of his office. Well, about 6 weeks later, another guy told me to do that. And I in turn threw him out of his office. This was my first official affair that I got in trouble in.
Mm-hmm.
And fortunately, the guy who was our technical liaison with North Texas was a good guy, a country boy, about my father's age, and I had met several times, and we took an instant liking to each other. He hated hippies as much as I did.
Mm-hmm.
In fact, one time, I'll never forget the story, there were some hippies came in at one time and complained about the fact that they were mowing the bushes too low in the park, and they had no place to sleep, and they'd ask him if they'd wanted John Matt to take care of the situation. He said, "I'll take care of it." So next morning they came out there and all the bushes had been cut down.
Wow.
And so anyway, that's the kind of friend he was. So when I threw him out, I called John Matt and I said, "John Matt," I said, "this guy threw me out of his office because I was a Marine." I said, "I in turn threw him out of his office." And I said, "By the time I finish the call, security would already be on his way down here," because I said, "I've already called security." And I'm sure they're calling. I said, "I want to call them first and tell them I'll look through this guy out of his office."
Mm-hmm.
And I said, "You might want, if you want to call him too." And so he did. He called. He knew how to call security. He came on down too. And he was laughing because he came in. He made a joke out of it to this guy. And John Matt, they knocked on the door of security. And I opened the door, and he said, "You're going to let this guy in?" I said, "Sure. He can come on in. No problem." And, boy, the guy was just steaming, and John Matt was laughing. And security, which generally, I think most of those guys were former service guys, knew what had happened.
Mm-hmm.
So nothing happened except this guy, you know, he flirted at the fire and got his fingers burned. But anyway, he called the phone company, and he called my boss, and now, technically I was in trouble. I was not supposed to do things like that, and I got my first warning. You can't do that. No.
Right.
So, and then there were so many things. I'll just try to remember that. Because, again, the shock treatments wiped out a lot. I remember one time, I was in church, and First Methodist Church of Denton, which is just a good old standard Methodist church.
Mm-hmm.
And this preacher was kind of a hippie. He had a thing tied to the back of his head, and he was young, you know. But I liked listening to him preach, and he seemed like a nice guy, you know. And my wife's in the choir, so But during the Lombardi raids, he got up there and, make a long story short, he called the pilots murderers in the sermon. So I turned to the lady to my left, and I said, "Did you see what I think he said?" And he says, "Yes, he did." So I got up, and four or five other people got up, and I pointed at Linda. I said, "You need to get up." She didn't move.
Mm-hmm.
And as I walked out, I got his sermon, and I went home, and boy, she was, you know, she didn't say anything, but I could tell she's mad.
Mm-hmm.
And we had another discussion, and I said, how can you not be angry about what he said? I said, "Your dad was in the Air Force, you know?"
Mm-hmm.
And she said, "I don't care, you embarrassed me." I said, "Embarrassed you? After what he said?" And I said, how come you never support me? You know, you got in this business. Why don't you support me, you know? I'm your husband. I'm the one that's catching hell on this thing. And these other guys are catching hell, you know. And she just didn't care. She just didn't care. She just, you know, like I said, she didn't care about politics. She still didn't care about politics. You know, it's just, it's a day-to-day thing with her.
You were just on a different wavelength.
She just lives in a different world. You know, unless somebody's landing on the nearest mall, communist troops, she might pick up a, you know, a banner or a sign in protest. And I think what was so bad is that she just, on top of that, she just never helped me.
Right.
And I helped her in a couple occasions. And that brings up another occasion is that my daughter had ear problems, and she went to this doctor, and the guy made her wait 3 or 4 hours out in the deal and made me mad, and he did it a second time, and I went out to talk to him. Now, he wouldn't let me talk to him, and so I got a call one night from one of my Marine pals who is he's a friend of mine, and his wife was a nurse or worked in his office out there, and I want to tell you why he's making you wait. He says, he reviewed your file, and she had written down there in the form something about you were a former Marine something other in Vietnam, and he didn't like the war and so forth, so this is his way of punishing you, you know, through your daughter and your wife. And he said, "But you can't tell anybody." I said, "I won't." So I waited till after hours the next day. I know where his car was when he came out there. I said, "I'm Major Morris, and I'm the one that you don't like, and I'm the one that made my wife wait out here in the lobby and all that. You remember that?"
Mm-hmm.
"Yeah." And I said, "Why did you do this?" "Oh, no." I said, "Then did the war read?" He said, "No." I said, "Well, you're a liar. Are you going to do anything about it?" He did nothing, so I cold cocked him, you know,
oops,
in the nose, mm-hmm. Bloodied his nose, and I said, "You know, you don't mess with my family like that, pal. And you want to get up and do something about it, you can, but you don't mess with my family." And I didn't tell Linda because he'd be furious. In fact, years later, the thing came up, and I was talking to her. It's about last year. I was talking to her on the phone. I said, "I'm going to ask you something. I said, do you remember the time that doctor made you wait?" And I said, "Yeah." I said, "Did you ever know that what he did it for?" No, I said, "Because he was punishing me through you guys." And I went out there, and I told him that you don't treat my family that way, and that I knocked him down. And she kind of gasped, and I said, what would you have done if I told you that?" She said, "I would have got mad." And I said, "I figured you would." And I said, "What would you got mad? What would it be bad about?" She goes, "You know, she said, "You just embarrassed me." And I said, "That's what I thought." And I said, "You were truly useless." And so even after all that time, it was her feelings were to be left alone, nobody bother her. And I can remember a neighbor got into her skin one time over my daughter and her son, you know. And she come home crying about it and wanting me to do something about it and so forth. And I said, well, I'd do it, but, you know, it seemed like every time I do something for you or you do something, you know, you say I embarrass you. So, you know, it's between, I'll tell you what, it's between you and her. You just leave my daughter alone here and you go there by yourself. I'm tired of getting embarrassed, you know. And so, anyway, that was another time I got in trouble, and he reported. They all really reported to the phone company. He found out. And, of course, they couldn't do anything. He reported to my boss. He couldn't do anything. It was after hours.
Right.
But and he reported to the police, and that was the first time I fell out of SAR charges. This is the first time I met the police chief, and we actually became pretty good friends.
Mm-hmm.
And so, I mean, there was actually the beginning of a friendship. And the pastor infuriated me. So the next morning, I waited for him, hoped he'd show up before 8 o'clock, and he did. And this was the second time I hit somebody, and he came in there, and I was fuming. I told him, I said, those guys, and they're up there fighting a war, and I'm who I am, and I'm here to defend them. And I said, you know, I don't like it. And if you got anything to say, before I hit you.
Mm-hmm.
And he kind of looked at him, and he said something, and I broke his jaw, knocked him across his desk, and he fell down behind his chair and so forth. And before I got out of the car here at the end of the place, and I'm back down at the jail, and Jesus walking the jail, and they locked the door, unlocked it, come on out. We had another cup of coffee, and so, you know, let me go. And sure enough, I was fired again the time I got to the office. He was gloating this time. This time he did it. You know, you did it there in hours. It's 8:35, you're fired. And I said, I hate to pop your bubble, pal, but I said it happened about 7:15. And so, is he that? Yeah, but this time you hit a preacher. And I said, well, whatever. And so he reported it and so forth. And then my boss came down and said, what'd you do it for? And this was, you know, and I said, this is the next day. And I said, well, I'll just show you what he said. And I said, if you want to fire me, that's fine. But I said, I am going to appeal it, and I will go to the local newspaper with it. Because I knew that the editor of the paper here, I had met him because he was an Iwo Jima vet,
mm-hmm.
Marine type.
Mm-hmm.
And I said, I will go to Mr. Forgot his name. And I said, I will give him this piece of paper, and I will expose that bastard. You know, I will expose that bastard for what he did. And I said, there's no thing. And I said, he'll print the fact that how many people over there might have had kids over there or relatives over there with this. And so he took it, and kind of find out later, he was filing the papers to do it. And word got back to the area manager, and he saw a copy of what was done, and he killed it on the spot. And as time went by, I was going on 2 week leave. I was going on a 2 week to Florida with the Marines.
Mm-hmm. Because during this time you were in the U.S. Marine Corps Reserves. Yeah.
Yeah.
Uh-huh.
And so I'd been taking my own 2 weeks to go to home reserve, you know, my own company time, so mm-hmm. My own military time, so I could make company time money too. I could draw both pays. But this year I decided I was going to take company time off, and, you know. And so I went in there and told myself, we'll take me. And they said, no, you're not. And I said, yes, I am. You can do it. I said, I can. So I went and got the federal regs and said, it's a federal law that I can take my time. I'll get my pay I won't draw the pay, but I'll get my same job
mm-hmm.
and position back when I come home.
Mm-hmm.
And so I said, there it is, black and white, you know. And, of course, now you look at it, it's just almost ridiculous. You know, everybody does it now. But at the time, you know, nobody was being activated.
Right.
And so I went, and about Saturday night, 2 o'clock in the morning, I got a call from Linda. And she said that she got a call late that night from one of the ladies in the front office who had gotten word from one of my plant guys. And my plant guys turned out to be one of my some of my best pals.
Mm-hmm.
Because on this town, we had a manager that he had hired himself who was an alcoholic and a real jerk. I mean, he was a jerk. Mm-hmm. I once invited him to meet me out in the middle of the football field at Fouts Field, just him and me. And, you know.
Yeah.
He was an older guy, but he was a, So, anyway, he had, this is a later case. That was a later case. She learned from somebody in the office that he was bragging to his secretary, and his secretary was out in the open where the ladies were.
Mm-hmm.
And that he was going to fix me this time. He was going to transfer me to Sherman and still being good with the law because I'd get the same job, same money, same position. And she heard it. She called Linda.
Mm-hmm.
And he called me. And so the next morning I woke up. We always carried a legal officer with us. We never did use them, but just in case. I said, hey, I'm going to put you to work.
Mm-hmm.
And so I told him. So he called Marines, and they put him in touch with the Navy. Next thing I know, I'm talking to the Navy folks in Washington because this was such a, you know, unusual case. And I can remember this admiral coming on. He says, you want to tell me this thing one more time because I don't really believe it. I told him. And I said, yeah, this guy doesn't like me. He don't want anything to do with me. He doesn't like the Marines. Doesn't like the war. And so he's transferring those. And he says, give me this guy's number. I gave this not always home number. And he called him at 2 o'clock in the morning on a Sunday morning, you know,
mm-hmm.
just to harass the hell out of him.
Mm-hmm.
He told me he was. He told him, this is Admiral so-and-so, and I'm calling from the Navy Department in Washington. And he said, heard what you're doing, you know. Just want to let you know you're in violation of the law. And he commits to do this by the time Major Morris comes back to work Monday morning. He said, you will be fined $50,000. General Telephone will be fined $500,000, and their doors will be closed. Good night, Mr. What's so-and-so. And hung up the phone, didn't give him a return number or anything. And that was in the middle of the night. Yeah. And I thought that was great because the guy probably went back to sleep and said, next morning, did I dream that?
Did I dream it?
Yeah, well, you've done that before. You know. Did that really happen or not?
Gary, let's take a break there for a minute.